From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Andy Puddicombe was well on his way to being a Buddhist monk. He had grown up in England, and a series of events, some of them tragic, had led him to seek out a place where he could learn to calm his busy mind. And he was impatient to find the right teacher, which is ironic, of course. He moved from monastery to monastery, India, Nepal, Burma, Thailand. And over time, he found a way to meditate, to achieve what he calls some headspace, which he describes as this sense of peace or fulfillment. And he wanted to share it, but outside of a monastery, with people who weren't interested in spiritual enlightenment necessarily. They just wanted to know how to switch off. Puddicombe has created a very popular app, and today in the program he's joining is to explain how you get some headspace. After the news.
Hey, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, inviting you to check out Video West. It's our online showcase of short documentaries about the places and people that make Utah what it is. You can stream the films at videowest.kuer.org, and if you like what you see and hear, we hope you'll share it with your friends. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The route to where Andy Puddicombe finds himself these days as a teacher with an incredibly popular meditation program and app has been interesting. From his home in southwest England to monasteries in India, Nepal, Burma, among other places, from there to a degree in circus arts. In his book, he admits it doesn't seem like a natural transition from Buddhist monk to clown, but there are similarities. Both pursuits, he says, require a presence, a brutal honesty to put something out there and just see what happens. When he was performing as a clown, for example, he says what mattered was putting aside his ego and just going out there and doing it. And I suppose the same can be said for trying to be in the present, in the moment. Here's a statistic Puddicombe uses to explain why more of us need to meditate. 47% of our life is spent, he says, lost in thought, that is, distracted. Andy Puddicombe is joining us today. Some of you may use the app he's created. It's called Headspace. 10 minutes a day, he says, is all you need to recalibrate your mind and get some headspace, which he describes as that place where you just know everything is going to be okay. Andy Puddicombe is a former Buddhist monk. We'll talk about that story. Later completed a degree in circus arts, which I mentioned. He is co-founder of Headspace and the author of 3 books, among them Get Some Headspace, The Headspace Guide to Mindful Eating, and the latest, The Headspace Guide to Mindful Pregnancy. He's joining us today from a studio in Venice, California. Andy Puddicombe, welcome. Thanks very much for doing this.
It's a pleasure. Morning, Doug.
Morning. I guess I wanted to back up a little bit and get a sense of your first experience with meditation. And we'll explain how we think about meditation, what it is exactly. But your first experience with it was, you were fairly young. You were 11 years old, I guess. That is the
Yeah, I was pretty young. I think I was about 10, 11 years old. And my parents at the time were going through, I was a messy divorce, but a divorce which was very difficult, very stressful. And Mum was looking for a way to cope, and she signed up for a local meditation class. And I just asked if I could go along, and I was really surprised. It wasn't what I thought it would be, and I was surprised how quickly the mind sort of quietened down.
You say in your book that you had never sat still for one place for such a long period of time.
No. I think at the age of 10 or 11.
Yeah, of course.
Young boys, young kids, like, you know, always moving around, and I was very sporty and athletic, and it was really a strange thing to even want to do at that age. But there was a draw of some kind, and the idea of experiencing stillness of mind was an attractive proposition even then, even at that age.
You say the next time you tried it, though, you didn't get the same experience. And in fact, you got kind of frustrated. And this seems to be the thing that I think all of us work through. And we'll talk a little bit about this. And that is the idea, and this is how you describe it in your book, battling with your own mind. What is that essential place that we're all struggling with? It's just these incoming thoughts and no way to kind of filter them or set them aside, I guess.
Yeah, I think the... The main challenge for people kind of learning meditation, so certainly mine when I began, is that there's this idea that prevails that when we sit to meditate, just because we're doing something called meditation and just because we're sat still with our eyes closed, that the mind will immediately stop thinking. And of course, that's not the nature of mind. Why should the mind that's always been thinking suddenly stop thinking? And so if we have that idea, a very strong idea that we need to stop thoughts, then there's going to be conflict in the mind. Thoughts are going to be arising, and then there's going to be another voice kind of saying, go away, I don't want you to be here. So it takes a little time, I think, to get used to the idea that meditation is not about stopping thoughts. If it were that easy, you know, we wouldn't need to do this stuff. It's more about learning to step back and to witness thoughts coming and going, not getting involved. And when we do that, the mind naturally finds a place of calm. Mm.
You write in your book that there wasn't necessarily a particular moment that made you think about becoming a Buddhist monk. But there were a series of things that really got you thinking, and some of them was sort of tragic. I mean, you had a stepsister, Joanne, who was killed on her bike. You learned about an ex-girlfriend who had died while having heart surgery. And all of these things, I think, happened within the course of a couple of months. And then a big one, you're a drunk driver plowed into a crowd of friends. There were some people that saw this. Leaving you feeling what? I mean, was that sort of a clincher moment in some ways?
It's funny. It took a number of years, I think, to really even sink in. You know, I think when things like that happen in life, I don't think, it doesn't matter what age we are. Like, we're not trained to deal with grief at any stage of life, really. And everybody deals with it in different ways. I think at that stage, I was probably kind of 18 years old. And I think, you know, I felt very angry. I felt very confused. I felt very sad, a bit depressed, and didn't really know. So I kind of just ran away for a little while. You know, I went to one country and worked there for a while, and I kind of thought that I might be able to outrun my mind. And it wasn't until kind of I eventually went off to a monastery where I realized that, oh, okay, the mind travels with us wherever we go, and it doesn't matter whether we're sitting in a quiet monastery on a Himalayan hilltop or whether we're in the middle of a busy city. The mind is the mind, and the monastery simply provides a conducive environment in which to train the mind. But definitely those series of events that happened kind of, as you said, over a period of 3 to 6 months, I think they definitely kind of galvanized something in me. It wasn't just simply wanting to get away. It was a desire to find out what peace of mind really was, you know, to go beyond simply reading books, taking in more information, and to actually delve in experientially to try and understand what is this thing that's called the mind and how do we find a place of contentment and peace within it.
You tell this really powerful story in your book. I think this was when you were at the first monastery you experienced, and you were talking with this with a teacher. And these emotions, these tragedies from these experiences, kept kind of coming to the surface, you say, and making you sad. And you didn't quite know what to do with it, and so you went to talk to this teacher, and you say that you fully expected him to give you some secret technique to put aside the sadness or something. And instead, he asks you this question. He asked you this: do you like it when someone makes you laugh? Now, would you take that story from there? Because I think this is instructive about emotions and how they fit in the scheme of things.
Yeah, you might. Can you give me I wrote that book a long time ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Can you give me just a little bit more of a flavor that conversation
went? Well, this was the moment where you said he told you that you were looking for the wrong kind of happiness. This is the story you tell where you are looking for the original emotion of sadness. And he told you that you had this idea of how well, you kind of had this argument with him because he was trying to give you the sense of what sadness was, and he said that you had an idea of how it makes you feel, instead of what it actually is. I guess, does that make sense?
I think that's it does, and I think the reason that I included it in the book, the reason it struck a chord with me is I think so often in life we look at events and we're inclined to look outward and to blame our feelings on certain events. And of course, terrible things happen in the world and it's right to look outside and try to make sense of them. But I think internally, when we experience an emotion, the emotion itself is not inherently good or bad. It is simply an emotion. It's a feeling. And we can only kind of think about whether it's good or bad retrospectively. Mm-hmm. But what often happens when we experience a feeling like sadness or anger, we may feel that that's kind of not how things should be because we think that we should be happy. So when those emotions arise, we tend to resist them. And the more we resist them, the more we create conflict in the mind. This emotion is looking to simply arise, to be recognized, and to pass on, you know. But because we hold it in place and because we constantly think about it, we actually create a whole story around the emotion. And it's amazing, you know, Doug. We get letters, a lot of letters in at Headspace, and I'm reminded of a woman who wrote in a few, I don't know, probably a couple of years back now. And she said that 40 years ago, her husband had cheated on her in a marriage and they'd separated. And for 40 years, every single day, she had replayed this storyline in her mind, this feeling of bitterness and sadness and anger that she'd experienced. And she said it wasn't until she started to meditate that she realized that actually she was doing that. She'd always thought that he'd done it to her. But although the original event he had, like he'd created the conditions, she had kept that alive in her own mind and she was the one that had suffered. And she said it was only in actually kind of letting go of that storyline that sadness and that bitterness and anger was able to kind of dissipate and dissolve. And, you know, that's obviously over a really long period of time. I think we all do that day to day. We hold on to these emotions. We create stories around them. And as a result, we suffer more.
How is it that, give us a sense of how it is that you ended up actually going off to become a Buddhist monk. You had been brought up as a Christian, but you didn't really feel, yeah. You say in your book, a connection to a particular religion. And Buddhism was kind of appealing, I think if I understand this right from reading your book, because it didn't really feel like a religion. I mean, you weren't really caught up in that part of it. What was appealing about the idea of being a Buddhist or a Buddhist monk anyway?
Well, I think at least the way that I had been brought up was that there was a really strong heritage of meditation and not mysticism, but yeah, that's meditation kind of in the East, whether it's kind of Hindu or Buddhist. And the thing that attracted me about the Buddhist kind of way was that for me, it wasn't a religion. There was nothing, I wasn't being asked to believe anything. I was simply being encouraged to be curious and to look at the mind, to observe the mind and to experience. And for me, that was a fundamental difference from how I'd kind of grown up and, you know, going to church and being told this is what you must believe and here's why. And I found it really kind of very liberating to be able to just kind of say, OK, the starting place is this moment now and I'm just going to sit and observe. So for me, it was quite an easy decision to go away and do that. It does sound, I appreciate, and probably on a resume, looks rather a bizarre career choice. But, you know, people talk about it being a calling, and it was really like that. You know, in that moment, I can't even call it a decision to go away. There was a feeling that was so strong, it couldn't have been any other way. Yeah. I couldn't have resisted it. Like, I just had to go and do that thing. I set off when I was about 21, 22, yeah. Something like that.
And your student council said it was the biggest mistake that you would ever
Yeah. Yeah, I was studying sports science at the time and doing pretty well with my studies and stuff, but just not really feeling fulfilled. And I went in one afternoon, probably just at the beginning of my second year, and I said, look, you know, I'm going to leave. And he said, you know, well, you're crazy. What are you going to do? And I'm going to be a Buddhist monk. And he said, yeah, well, he said, this is the, well, first he said, you need to go and see your doctor and get some Prozac.
Right.
And then the second thing he said was, this is the biggest mistake you've ever made, you're ever going to make, and you're going to regret it for the rest of your life. Which was, you know, I get where he was coming from, but it was an extraordinary thing to say in retrospect.
Yeah. What did you imagine that life to be? I mean, did you idealize it? Did you have a sense of what it really meant? Did you imagine how long you might live this way? Or did you just think, I'm just going to just start?
Yeah, I had a very romantic view of it. As I say, you know, I genuinely thought you could kind of roll up to the monastery, just hang up all your life, you know, even shortish lifetime at that stage, but a lifetime of baggage kind of outside and just sit in kind of bliss in this monastery. And it was very, very different from that. You definitely get that honeymoon period. Mm-hmm. It's kind of maybe like a few weeks, a month or a couple of months where it's just nice to be out of the hustle and bustle, to be free of, you know, the normal kind of responsibilities and commitments. But then all of a sudden you realize, you know, there's just you and the mind and there's nothing else. There's no distractions. There's nowhere to hide. And it's like seeing the mind, seeing oneself clearly for the very first time, perhaps. And that can be deeply uncomfortable as well as extremely kind of liberating and at times pleasant. So there's a little bit of both. I didn't know whether I was going to do it for, I think I'm a little bit kind of all or nothing in character, I think, Doug. So I think I went away thinking like, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do it forever. So that was the intention at the beginning.
But it's interesting. I mean, you went from place to place to place, Nepal and India and Burma and Australia and Scotland. What were you looking for in particular? I mean, I guess the idea was to find the right teacher, the right way of practicing.
Yeah, and it's such a subtle thing. Like I stayed at monasteries, some for several years at a time, and it wasn't that it wasn't extremely beneficial. Yeah. You know, it was, but I just felt kind of, you know, certain aspects of the mind hadn't kind of been unlocked, for want of a better word, you know. And I guess the best example I can give of that is, you know, I'd spent about 5 years training in a very traditional, kind of very strict kind of school of meditation and Buddhism. And I remember traveling to a friend I was visiting back in the UK, and a friend took me to a Tibetan Buddhist monastery in Scotland. And there was so much kind of joy and warmth and laughter around the place. It was so different from, you know, the very, very serious monastery that I'd come from. And I was really touched by the warmth and the compassion of the teachers and how just as much emphasis was put on compassion and empathy and, you know, thinking about others as it was simply training in awareness and attention and focus. And so discovering those things along the way, for me, was a really important part of the journey. And it was, you know, discovering teachers who specialized in particular types of meditation and perhaps spending a year or two with them and then them recommending another teacher. And so I feel very fortunate to have been in lots of different environments. I think that's what enables me now to teach as I do. I think if I'd have just gone to one monastery and stayed there for 10 years, I don't know if I ever would have left.
Right.
But I also, I'm not sure I would have that same kind of breadth of teaching available, perhaps.
In Scotland, you've described that experience as coming to this kind of subtlety of mind and that it left you no longer searching for something. And that seems important, this idea of searching and just being content with I guess, where you are, as opposed to searching for something else, always moving to the next thing.
Yeah. And I think if you think about kind of meditation as an idea, that idea of simply resting in the present moment, kind of not kind of reaching out into the future, into that which we don't even know yet, and not looking back and dwelling in the past, but instead simply watching the present moment unfold moment after moment, that is that experience. And I think it was partly the teacher in that monastery, but it was also the fact that it was a year-long cloistered retreat. So there was a time to really kind of settle in to the meditation. And within a retreat context, it's quite a lot of meditation every day. And it just provides a very particular set of conditions for the mind to experience the mind in a very different way, I would say.
Andy Puddicombe is with us. He is co-founder of Headspace, author of the book Get Some Headspace. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking about meditation or mindfulness with Andy Puddicombe. He used to be a Buddhist monk. He's created an immensely popular app called Headspace. Some of you may use it every day for 10 minutes. And Puddicombe says that's really all you need to get some headspace. We'll talk about what that is exactly as we go along. He's joining us today from a studio in Venice, California. Let's start with what meditation is exactly, because you talk about how it's not – I think people think about it as becoming a different person or becoming a new person.
Yeah.
Or you say it's not that, and not even becoming a better person. It's about training more than that, I guess.
It is. I think it's about understanding the mind, and I would look at it as a skill. Like any skill, it requires practice, and it kind of takes time as well. The really important thing I would say is that it's not for me to tell anybody what meditation is. I genuinely believe that meditation is defined by the intention of the user. So let me just kind of make some sense of that. So, for example, we have parents who use it because they're tired and they're stressed out looking after their kids. We have kids who use it in schools because they want to kind of concentrate better or because their teachers want them to concentrate better. We have Olympic athletes who use it because they're trying to win a kind of a gold medal. We have people who incorporate it into their faith and into their traditions. It can be used in so many different ways, and I genuinely believe that the reason we begin to use it may not always be the reason we continue to use it. But the quality we're talking about, so just to differentiate between mindfulness and meditation, because I think they're often used interchangeably, they're a little different. So mindfulness is the ability to be present in the moment, undistracted. So often in life, you know, we're walking down the street, but we're not really aware of walking and we're not really aware of what's going on around us because we're thinking of a conversation we had kind of yesterday or we're planning for the weekend or whatever it might be. So there's that kind of constant distraction. There's always that kind of inner chatter in the mind. So mindfulness are those moments when we let go of that inner chatter and we really feel present in the world. Now, we can do that in any situation. It could be eating, walking, chatting, kind of playing some music, whatever it is. But it's quite tricky to learn that skill. And for most people, it'll be an experience which just sort of comes and goes in life. Mm-hmm. So we need a framework where we actually kind of take ourselves out of everyday life and we sit down and we train the mind. And it can be for as little as 5, 10, 15 minutes a day. And when we do that, we start to experience more of the present moment. We know how to kind of experience that quality, and we can then start to practice that in every part of life. So this isn't about removing yourself from the world kind of and heading off to the Himalayas. This is about how do you find a short amount of time each day to train the mind to be more present, not only for your own happiness but also for the relationships in your life as well.
And one thing that you do in these sessions, and I'll confess that I've had to start three times.
Yeah.
With the 10. And I'm guessing I'm not that's not unusual.
Not at all.
Right? And so, but one of the things I've noticed in them, at least these initial ones, so I'm really early on in all of this. And one thing I've noticed is you say in those initial sessions, it's okay to hear street noise. It's okay to, you know, there's a dog barking in the background. Don't worry about that. Just let's start basic, right? Is that the idea? Forget about all of that part, at least at first.
Yeah, and I think, again, there's this idea that we have to kind of be in a padded cell somewhere, kind of, you know, completely away from all the noise. But if we live in a city, like, that's never going to happen. And genuinely, even in the monastery at times, when it got a bit too quiet, the teachers would even bring in kind of like loud, noisy dogs to kind of just try and sort of, you know, prod you a little bit just to test the quality of mindfulness, the stability of mindfulness. So, yeah, I encourage people when they sit down, rather than thinking all of that is getting in the way of a quiet mind, the noise isn't getting in the way. Our resistance to the noise is getting in the way. So the moment we drop that resistance and kind of it's like, okay, oh, yeah, there's a dog. Okay, and then the mind gets bored of listening to the dog
and the mind, the attention comes back to the breath again. Mm-hmm. And then maybe it's a next door neighbor doing some DIY, and then the mind gets bored of that and it comes back to the breath again. Over time, those kind of external noises, sensations, whatever they might be, become less of a challenge, I think.
That breath is important. There's a really great profile of you in the New Yorker magazine. Lizzie Whittacombe says that you savor the breath the way some people do wine. would you talk about that? I like that idea of breath, because you do keep saying, okay, yeah, it's all right, you can drift off for a little bit, but let's try to come back a little bit to the breath.
Yeah, I think the breath is it's a great object to meditate. So whenever we're trying to focus the mind in a particular way, we need something to focus on. And it doesn't have to be the breath. We can focus on something external, something we can see or hear. It might be a visualization. But I think the breath is probably the easiest. And it's with us all the time, Duck, you know, wherever we go. So there's always the ability to come back to the breath. And our breath reflects how we're feeling, what's going on in our mind. If you think about those times when we might feel very kind of stressed and overwhelmed, and if we look at the breath in those moments, it's quite short, it's quite shallow, actually. And then when we're really relaxed, maybe we're kind of, I don't know, relaxing in the bathtub or something like that, then the breath really starts to kind of slow down and it gets a lot deeper, and it's a reflection of what's happening in the mind. So it's not that we're trying to artificially change the breath, but by bringing our attention to the breath, we start to understand those things. And interestingly, when we bring our attention to it, it naturally starts to slow down without any effort at all. So it's almost in being more aware, the body knows how to reset itself to a natural place of calm.
When did you come upon the term headspace? When did that first occur to you? Because it's a very distinctive idea, headspace.
Yeah. So I should say as well, kind of headspace as a, although I was doing some work kind of one-to-one in clinics and things kind of after leaving the monastery, probably about 7 years ago, I met my co-founder, now very dear friend, Rich Pearson. And he comes from a creative background, working in a marketing company. And we've been throwing ideas around for a couple of months, thinking, you know, what are we gonna call this thing? And we were driving down the road. I remember we were driving down to his father's house, actually. And Rich said, it's got to have something with head in it. It's got to feel kind of tangible, like real. It can't be kind of mind, which is very intangible. And I said, well, that's fine. I said, but it's got to have a feeling of spaciousness. It's got to have space in it. And then we just both kind of looked at each other. I think he almost crashed. And we're like, headspace. And headspace was born. You know, it was that easy.
Well, explain what you mean by headspace, because in the book, you talk about there being a lot of times, I think there's this idea to say we've arrived at a kind of a moment of happiness. But in the book, you say there's a distinction between headspace and happiness or emotion. I mean, and it's an important distinction.
I think it's a really important distinction, and I think it's the cause of much confusion around meditation. So when we're talking about happiness, like this is often happiness, we often, you know, we talk about it in terms of an emotion. So, you know, we did that and we felt very happy, or we saw that person, and when we were with that person, we felt really happy. But those things and those people kind of come and go in our lives, and so there's no kind of, you know, they're quite unstable in that way, if you like. So we might be really happy one day, really kind of sad the next day, then we might feel angry the next day. So the emotions are always changing. Headspace, or kind of contentment, if you like, is, I would say, it's not happiness in that sense. It's a deeper sense of fulfillment, say of contentment. And because of that, it's not really kind of impacted very much by our emotions. So it sounds really strange at first, but we could feel really happy and content. We could feel really sad and content. We could even experience anger and yet feel quite content. It's not that we're dwelling in the emotion. It's not that we're saying, oh yeah, it's a really good thing to be angry. That's not the thing at all. It's just that there's this ease in the mind, a sense of not judging our thoughts and our emotions, not being overly critical of our thoughts and emotions. Instead, kind of being a little kinder, a bit more gentler towards our own mind and kind of saying, okay, these thoughts, these feelings, they come and go. That's okay. Like, because they come, they have to go. But all the time, there is this space of contentment. And once we know how to find that and to rest in that, then I think it usually leads to quite a fundamental change in the way we experience our life.
You say that it's about changing the way in which you see the world. And I don't want to put you on the spot with another story from the book that you've written a few years
sure,
ago.
It's okay.
But so, surely you remember Joshi, a man in India. Mm. Joshi had this incredibly tragic experience, which changed the way he felt and where he experienced feelings. Do you feel comfortable telling that story?
Yeah, of course. I think that story really stuck with me. He was someone who I met on my travels on my time in India, and I was just really struck by this individual who had experienced so much kind of tragedy in his life. You know, and you'll know from reading the book, Doug. You know, along the way, he'd lost his wife, and he'd lost his children, and he eventually lost his father. And there was in a series of, you know, situations that it would almost be hard to believe, you know, if we saw it in a film or something, never mind to imagine actually experiencing those things, you know, sort of car crashes and house fires. And listening to him, you know, like, he had every single right to be completely devastated, to just be in a state of depression. And for the rest of his life, and I think everybody would look at him and understand why he might feel like that. And yet somehow, like, he had transcended that. It's not that he didn't experience, you know, when he talked about it, there were still tears in his eyes. He still experienced sadness, but there was an underlying joy and contentment which in no way conflicted with that sadness. You know, he had found a place where, yes, it was incredibly sad, but it was also okay. And that sense of kind of okayness, I think if we can find that in our life, doesn't negate the suffering and the difficulty and the terrible things that can happen in life to ourselves and to others. But it does provide us with a place of, if you like, kind of safe harbor, not as an escape, but just a place where we feel a greater sense of spaciousness in the mind, I think a greater sense of interconnectivity with the people around us, but most of all, just in touch with that place of peace, contentment, fulfillment that I think we all seek in our lives.
Mm. You say meditation, you kind of break it down into three distinct practices, three distinct aspects. And I wanted to work our way through some of these. The first is approach. Is this idea of sort of changing the way you see the world, is this part of this approach part?
I think it is, but it's not the approach in this context is not such an intellectual idea. It's not kind of, because we all know, right, we can read a book and it says, oh, well, try looking at every challenge as an opportunity rather than a challenge. And then the next opportunity arises and we're like, no, this actually is a challenge. This is really difficult. So sort of knowing it intellectually is kind of almost not enough. The approach, I would say, is it's how we meet every situation that arises in our life, whether that's a thought, a feeling, or something external. The easiest way to talk about it or to describe it is, let's say you're sitting down to do your first meditation and you think, okay, meditation is all about clearing thoughts, stopping thoughts. Okay, so right there, immediately we've created an obstacle. We just didn't know that that's not what it's about. And so we find it difficult, we get frustrated, and we give up. But if we understand that, oh, actually, the way to approach meditation is to step back, to allow thoughts and feelings to come and go, to recognize that the mind will wander, but each time we bring it back to the breath, then we have a positive experience and we're far likely to continue with it. So in understanding, kind of, it's more about understanding how to, skillfully approach each new moment in a very experiential way, rather than some kind of philosophy or intellectualization of the process.
In your book, you write about something that I imagine a lot of people may struggle along the way. And this idea was, you say you struggled with this idea of not to do something, being passive. I mean, meditation seems like such a completely passive, sedentary sort of thing.
Yeah.
So how can that be, as you say in your book, how can that lead to any long-lasting change? And so you talk about this experience at one of the monasteries where a teacher said, helped you work through this, and he said, he told you to imagine a blue sky.
Yeah. So this one, it remains one of my favorite analogies and metaphors, and in fact, we even created an animation out of it at Headspace. And it's just that idea that the blue sky, this kind of contentment, this quality of mind, this innate quality of mind, is always with us. And some days, of course, when it's very cloudy in the sky, there's lots of thoughts, lots of dark clouds, kind of we forget that blue sky is there. And yet we know, if we've ever been in a plane or stared at the sky for long enough, that beyond those clouds, there's more blue sky. Like, that blue sky is always there. It's just that we forget because we get so caught up in the clouds. And I feel like that's such a useful thing, not only for meditation, remembering that we don't have to sit there trying to create peace of mind, but just for everyday life, to know in those moments when life is extremely difficult, when we feel very stressed, to know that that quality of mind is inherent, that it's always with us, that we don't have to try to be more relaxed, that we don't have to try to create that. Instead, it's more about kind of letting go that which obscures it. I feel like that's such a liberating kind of idea. But we can certainly move closer to it as an experience through meditation.
I think the image or metaphor that seemed to help me in my racing mind work the best was the image you write about of imagining your unsettled mind like a wild horse.
Yeah.
which I really, that I have to say, that kind of works for me.
Yeah. Again, another one of my favorite ones. And of course, the many of the Tibetan teachers, you know, they came from Tibet or they came from Mongolia. And this idea of kind of taming a wild horse, which they would do on the steeps. And the idea is that, look, if you take a wild horse and you try and kind of hold it in one place, or you try and jump on its back straight away, it will kick and it will buck and it will be really, really restless. So the way that they would do it is to put very loosely around the neck a little bit of rope and a really long piece of rope. And they would let the horse run away on this piece of rope, still holding on to the end. And this horse would feel like it had all the space in the world. And it would kind of run around. And it's not even aware that there's any attention kind of there at all. And then slowly, day by day, the horse is kind of brought in just a little bit more each day. Until eventually, the horse is comfortable just resting right next to the person who's been kind of breaking that horse in. So, and we can do the same thing with the mind. So rather than kind of sitting there thinking, right, okay, I'm going to meditate, I'm going to shut out all my thoughts, instead, kind of just very gently giving the mind the space. It's going to think. That's fine. Let it think. The moment you realize the mind's wandered off, just bringing the mind back to the breath again. And that will happen a lot to begin with. And over time, to begin with, it might be kind of like it wanders for 5 minutes. And then it's 3 minutes. And then it's just a minute. And then it's 30 seconds. And then it's 10. And over time, we start to kind of get a little bit better at just creating that space in which the mind is very comfortable just being rather than doing.
Andy Puddicombe is with us. He is the author of 3 books, Get Some Headspace, The Headspace Guide to Mindful Eating, and now The Headspace Guide to Mindful Pregnancy. He's joining us from a studio in Venice, California. We need to take a break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Andy Puddicombe. We are he's the co-founder of Headspace. We're talking about mindfulness, meditation, how you get Some Headspace. That's the name of one of his books, Get Some Headspace. He's joining us from a studio in Venice, California. So we talked a little bit about approach. Another one of these aspects is the practice itself. Give us a sense of, I know you talk a lot about this, but where you start. I mean, because it seems like the idea of getting ready, the idea of just really just sitting down and finally doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the first thing to say about practice is that, look, like learning any new skill, we're not going to learn it unless we actually do it. There are so many people who've talked about meditation, read about meditation, thought about doing it, but never actually done it. It's a bit like carrying a gym bag on our back full of, you know, with our sneakers and our gym kit and never actually kind of going to the gym. So unless we actually sit down and do it on a regular basis, there's no way that we're going to experience the benefits of it. So the way to begin, and obviously, you know, there are many ways. I'm a little biased as the co-founder of Headspace, but I really believe, you know, and we have something like, I don't know, about 4 million plus people using it now, which gives me some confidence. But one of the easiest ways is, you know, you can download the app. It's free to download and you can just try. And I think that's the key thing. Look, just try it, even if you think it's not something for you. Try 10 minutes for 10 days and see if it makes a difference. All you need to do is to find a place where you're not going to be disturbed. It doesn't have to be completely quiet all around you, but just where you're not going to be disturbed. I normally recommend the morning, Doug. I don't know. Everyone's different, and you need to find the time of day that works best for you. But I think there's something nice about starting the day with this kind of, you head out into the day feeling a little bit fresher. You don't have all that kind of grogginess from the night before. And I don't know, you're that much more likely to be mindful throughout the day as well, to be more present. There was a chap who got in touch with us a little while back and he said, look, yeah, the meditation stuff, that's fine. You know, it's nice. I feel good and everything. But the thing I really love about it is that when I start my day with it, I make better choices throughout my day. I'm that much more likely to get some exercise. I'm that much more likely to be aware of the kinds of food I'm eating. I'm that much more likely to stop and pause before saying something that I might later regret to someone who I really care about. And to me, that's a really kind of, it's a great way of, a great example of why it's so useful to start the day in that way.
So, which tells us what about the human mind then? When we're not, it's not organized, but when we're not aware, we don't eat right, we don't exercise, we can't really organize all these things going on in our minds, I guess.
Yeah, we just feels like we're caught up in the middle of a storm, right? We're just being buffeted from place to place, thing to thing, situation to situation. The way I've always thought about it, I don't know if it's a good way, but kind of if you imagine sort of being out in a field and there being a really big sort of storm, you know, and you just kind of, it's not very pleasant and all you're kind of focusing on is just getting from one side of the field to the other. Mm-hmm. And the difference, I would say, when we are aware, when we are mindful, it's a little bit like sitting on the inside of the house looking out at that field and we're watching that storm. And I don't know about you, Doug, but as a kid growing up in England, I used to love that. Like there was something amazing. You look out, you see the power of nature, lightning and thunder and rain. And rather than it being a terrifying experience, it's amazing to watch. And in just the same way, when we're going about our life, like all these things, if we have an awareness, it's like we have that extra little bit of space, as though we've stepped back behind the glass where we get to experience it in a slightly different way.
Here's one question. We're getting a number of questions about certain particulars. Andrew wonders, what is your opinion of meditative aids? And I don't know what these mean, but I'm sure you might. Binaural beats and isochronic tones, those things?
Yeah. So I think over the last like 30 or 40 years in the West, I never saw any of these things in the East, by the way, but in the West, I think these things kind of became more popular. I think they were designed as kind of, look, if you find meditation difficult, here's like a shortcut. And by, I'm not sure if it makes sounds or vibrations, kind of that it's supposed to kind of induce a meditative state. I don't know anything really. I'm no expert on these things. Well, all I would say is, look, we in life, I think it's really important not to be dependent on anything. Kind of if we're talking about our own sense of contentment, our own sense of happiness. And if we're in the middle of a very difficult situation or a very difficult conversation with somebody, and we say, oh, excuse me a minute, I'm starting to get a little bit stressed out. Do you mind if I just put on this headband so I can kind of just feel a little bit more relaxed, and then I'll communicate a lot more pleasantly with you? Do you mind?
Yeah.
Like, that's a little odd and probably not terribly useful. So it might be a useful relaxation tool, but I'm not sure how helpful it is in establishing genuine stability of awareness and compassion moment to moment throughout the day.
The idea of integration. Let's talk about that. That's one of these, that really critical point. Where does this fit in terms of the steps? Now, this is the idea. Now we have the proper sort of mindset and approach. We understand the practice. What, the integration is the doing it part, I guess, or the integrating into our actual lives?
It is. You know, it's definitely one of the most neglected parts. I feel like meditation has come from East to West, and most people just think of, well, it's just sitting there cross-legged with your eyes closed, and that's it. But even if we, well, one, you don't have to sit cross-legged with your eyes closed. You can do it sitting on a chair and have your eyes open if you like. But even if you do that for 10 minutes every day, what about the other 23 hours and 50 minutes? Like, that's a really big part of the day. We can't kind of say that it is just about the 10, 15 minutes. The 10, 15 minutes is simply about familiarizing ourselves with that feeling of being present so that we can then carry that into our life and apply it to every single thing we do. And it doesn't matter. There is no aspect, no part of our life that doesn't require our mind to be a part of it. And as long as that's the case, then we will always benefit from a calmer, a clearer mind, a mind which is hopefully, as I say, more content, but also more compassionate, as interested in the happiness of others as it is in its own happiness.
John sends this from Salt Lake City. Says he's been using the app now for a little over a year, he says, and it mentions how helpful it is. Before using it, he says, I felt lost when I tried to meditate. I didn't know what to do. By using the app, I've learned actually several strategies for meditating on my own.
Right.
Which is, that's part of the point, I guess, for you in some way.
Yeah, again, I am all for, you know, people feeling as though they are able to take responsibility. They don't feel dependent on this thing. I think, you know, look, as we grow at Headspace, you know, there will be a stronger element of community and stuff that kind of helps people, even if they do have their own practice, kind of feel like they're part of something bigger. But yeah, absolutely. If people find things that work for them, as long as they feel confident and they're following certain kind of guidelines and doing it with good intention, good motivation, then that's a great thing.
John mentions that you recently added a series on depression. I referenced the books on mindful eating, mindful pregnancy. What other topics, he wonders, might you be adding in the future?
Yeah, well, first of all, John, thank you for using the app, and thanks for writing in with your questions. I think on the app, right now, it's split out into health, performance, and relationships. And for example, if you go into the health vertical, you'll find packs on sleep and on stress and on anxiety and depression, self-esteem. There's a number of things. And most of those are currently part of research projects as well, many of them in clinical trials, both in the UK and the US. So we're trying not to release things too quickly because we want them to be kind of part of trials so that they are better understood from a scientific point of view as well as an experiential point of view. But as we move into next year, Headspace for Kids is probably the biggest launch next year that we have going on. We just finished a pilot study in schools in Seattle, public schools in Seattle and LA, with some fantastic results. I'm really excited about seeing that launch. And then we've also got Headspace for Sport. We developed an entire sort of pack that, along with the British Olympic team, ahead of Rio next year. And yeah, we're really excited to see how the sport kind of the sport content unfolds as well.
I know you like to surf.
I do.
Yeah. what is the importance of surfing for you? Does this lend itself to the idea of having a direct action of being out there, of being present?
Yeah. For me, it does. You know, I don't think there's, I mean, there's not really kind of any part of life that feels kind of separate from that. But I do feel there's something for me personally, something very special about surfing. And it used to be, I think, a little bit about kind of catching waves. My lack of ability is sort of compensated by my enthusiasm for surfing. I'm not a great surfer. But I think now it's more about just being in the water. Mm. And it kind of doesn't matter, you know. Maybe I'm catching waves, maybe I'm not. Maybe there are waves, maybe there's not. Simply being out immersed in nature in that way, there is something, incredibly peaceful about it. Something that, you know, we talk about these kind of qualities of mindfulness and meditation, and actually they are there to be found in nature. I think it's just rare these days that we get out into nature. It's rare that we leave our mobile phones, you know, at home and just kind of and get out and be on our own. So surfing, it's just a great way of being immersed.
Andy Puddicombe, co-founder of Headspace, author of three books, among them Get Some Headspace and the latest, The Headspace Guide to a Mindful Pregnancy, joined us from a studio in Venice, California. Andy Puddicombe, thank you very much for the time.
It's a pleasure, Doug. Thanks so much for having me on.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, with thanks to Lindsay Vickers. The show directed by Tim Slover. Video West produced by Josh Weathers. Radio West produced by Benjamin Bombard and Aileen Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.